You're listening to WHUS Stores. The views presented in this program may not reflect the views of the University of Connecticut, WHUS Radio, or the staff of the station. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences. The movie Locke from 1989 has Donald Sutherland playing a brutal warden who takes revenge on an inmate who's escaped from his prison once but was caught and brought back. Depictions of prison staff being evil are certainly not limited to this film, and we constantly see examples of the abuse that occurs in the prison system. Contrary to this, I think we can find some interesting ways in which wardens defy the brutal authoritarian stereotype. In the second part of this series on the death penalty, on Edge of Empathy, I look at wardens and their responsibilities in carrying out executions. And maybe, just maybe, we can find a sliver of empathy in a place where the walls scream and the prisoners whimper. My name is Jonathan, and I'm your resident journalist. Let's dive in.
I'm Ron McAndrew. I'm a prison and jail consultant, retired Florida prison warden, retired manager of Bluebell International, ex-U.S. Air Force.
McAndrew has overseen several executions by electric chair in Florida and shadowed several lethal injections in Texas. His journey to becoming a correctional officer started after he worked for a French perfume firm in Asia for a number of years.
I went every day for interviews, driving up from Homestead, and I was watching my bank account, and it was very slowly going broke, and my son was in high school back in France. I had to find something, and I was on the verge of going back to France, and someone recommended I go down to the prison. They were desperate for help. The personnel manager gave me a job in minutes.
The next several chapters of McAndrew's life would be defined by this career choice. As McAndrew ascended through the ranks of correctional officers, he was then asked to supervise executions. One thing that wardens are tasked with doing is practicing the execution protocol. This is where we start to get that empathetic take on the warden's job. It's messed up to know that you can practice something like this, but it's more comforting to know that the prison staff try their hardest to make sure that the execution goes smoothly, and by extension, that the inmate dies with as little pain as possible.
My grandparents raised me, taught me as a young boy, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
When he was getting involved with the prison system, he thought that the prisoners deserved to be in there. You do the crime and you pay the time. However, as any person does when surrounded by the same people every day, he started to bond with them.
And in the meantime, I've got 30 days before I'm going to execute this man, and I start getting to know him a little bit. I meet his mother, a couple of sisters, his attorneys. I'm talking to these people on the phone almost on a daily basis. And he suddenly, I was no longer dealing with a number. He was just a number the day I read him that death warrant, but now he's becoming more and more of a human being, and has two arms, two legs, two eyes, two ears, just like me.
While Ron is getting accustomed to his prison surroundings, there's another warden that's undertaking the same task. His name is...
Frank Culliver. I work for Alabama Department of Corrections for 37 plus years. I actually, I started in 81, I believe, coming out of college. I was the first warden to conduct an execution in Alabama by lethal injection.
As Culliver works up the ranks, he starts to realize the power that respect from the inmates can have.
With inmates overall, I feel like I've gained a certain amount of respect from them, because if I told you that I was going to do XYZ, and then I did XYZ. And so guys literally respect that. When I was assistant warden at Holman, I walked death row weekly, in excess of 150 inmates on death row. I would pick a day out of each week, and normally Thursday or Friday, but I would walk all the tiers of death row, entertain whatever concerns they had, et cetera, take notes, get back with them, et cetera, et cetera.
It's the little things that matter. In this case, Culver specifically did not read the inmates' files in order to not pass judgment on them or treat them as any less for it. It's pretty much the opposite of Warden Drumgoole, who vows to make life a living hell for Frank because he knows his track record. Yes, he starts to get to know the inmate and finds out that he has a family and kids just like he does, but at the end of the day, the inmate gets sent home in a body bag. For McAndrew's third execution, something goes terribly awry.
The minute the electricity was applied, there was a pop. I was standing about 3.5 feet away from the electric chair. And there was a plume of smoke that came out from underneath the helmet area, followed by a long flame, actually came right up in front of my face. The electrician who wears these high tension gloves that you could have actually removed the helmet, looked at me and said, "Continue." That was a question. And I knew there was no way we could back off at this point. So I told him, "Yes, we're going to continue." And now we've got all sorts of black smoke coming out from underneath the helmet and occasional flame. And it's obvious that we're not electrocuting this man. We are burning him to death. And for the next 6 minutes, looking out at the witnesses and the media in the witness room, these people were aghast. They were totally aghast. You could tell they were sick watching what we were doing. I can tell you, I was getting sick.
We come back with Culver's story and methods of supervision of the prison.
If I said I was going to do something, then I did my best to try to do that. So... we were able to change some of the conditions, and that wasn't just attributed to me, but the need was there. So the housing units were changed up to a degree. The bathrooms, et cetera, were reconstructed and renovated.
If inmates feel like they're being treated like people and their concerns are being listened to, then they will reciprocate in kind. Culver also took an emotionally detached approach to the job.
From an emotional standpoint, I treated it as a job. When I took the job there, when I accepted a promotion there, I knew what was involved with that. Having been the assistant warden there prior to and being involved with those executions, so it wasn't like I was going into something that was totally new or totally foreign.
So we've got two different approaches. Culver takes the job as it is, a job, but he still does little things like not read the file of the inmate, he takes their concerns into play, and he even says at one point that if he's going to do something about the inmate's conditions, like if he says he's going to do it, he will. He claimed that he was able to actually improve prison conditions as a senior warden several times. Returning to McAndrew's story, he becomes deeply invested in the inmates. By getting to know them, he humanizes them. At one point, he even mentions that receiving the Black Border Death Warrant note about one of the inmates under his supervision startled him. In the daily prison life, wardens supervise the inmates 8 to 12 hours a day, whether it be exercise or socialization. The inmates in question were starting to become somewhat of a friend in his mind. Unfortunately, the executions of these inmates took a toll on McAndrew.
Instead of having a glass of red wine before my dinner every night, I started drinking a half a bottle of Johnny Walker. I couldn't sleep. It started really, really torturing me. I retired for a few days and then worked for the jail for almost a year. And I've been doing this now. Getting back to the trauma, my wife is a nurse. She's a brilliant woman and we have a beautiful marriage. But alcohol wasn't helping me or her or in anything around us. And she began insisting that I reach out for help. And she finally called my doctor at the Veterans Administration and told him what was going on with me. I'd gotten to know Dr. Knapp quite well. He'd been my doctor for a number of years. So I went in to see him, and he told me that there was a therapist that had worked with patients in Virginia that were executed, and that she had suffered herself some of the same things that was bothering me. I agreed to see her, and I saw her once every couple of weeks for almost 13 years, and it did me a world of good.
The Veterans Administration diagnosed McAndrew with PTSD. These symptoms of PTSD aren't exclusive to McAndrew when it comes to wardens and executioners. He mentioned taking a surgeon off an execution team because the act of witnessing an execution was just too much to take for him. A research article by Jill Johnson and Johnson stated that executioners experience something called executioner stress, with symptoms like depression, nightmares, and impaired judgment. It's worth noting that while wardens aren't technically executioners, they still play a big part in overseeing executions and are privy to the same level of stress. This trauma and stress spurred McAndrew to resign from the position and later built the foundation for his anti-death penalty advocacy. In McAndrew and Culver's experiences, we see two very different perspectives. McAndrew humanized prisoners by finding out more about their backgrounds, while Culver cultivated respect among prisoners and tried his best to change conditions. In fact, a small sample study by Michael and Howard Ofsofsky of security officers who worked with executions stated that the most common sentiment among them was their professionalism. They said that at the end of the day, it is their duty to carry out their jobs as efficiently as possible. Throughout these two stories, empathy appears in the least likeliest of places. Before I end the episode, I want to discuss a fascinating contradiction. I showed you guys how prison officials show empathy in a place where we don't see much humanity being displayed. However, during the interview with McAndrew, he mentioned something quite dark.
There's a leather mask that's goes over the condemned face after he's given his last words. And that mask is bolted down so tight that it automatically breaks the nose. Witnesses don't know that. They don't see it. But you can hear it cracking because you're doing that so nobody can hear him scream, should he scream. And in other words, you got to have everything looking pretty, cosmetic. We had, I saw quite a bit of blood after the execution was over with and the witnesses had gone away. I realized that we had, during the 10, 12 minutes preparing to execute him with that mask over his face, that he had to be in some kind of agony, but he couldn't express himself. He couldn't even move his hands. He was strapped down all around. He could not heave his chest. That's why there are so many straps, is so that the witnesses do not see the heaving of the body, the tightening of the hands.
A disclaimer is that McAndrew is talking about the electric chair here, not the lethal injection method, but it's still relevant because there's still states that use the electric chair for execution. For lethal injection, the inmate is still strapped.
Anyway, we see that the wardens see the inmates as humans and treat them as such. Unfortunately, in a previous episode, there was an Associated Press article that detailed the sanitization and minimization of the inmates' pain in government reports. In reports by the prison, they refer to gurney as beds, and then refer to inmates' moans as snores. By Ron's account, the physical restraints on the gurneys prevent witnesses from seeing how much pain the inmate really goes through. We're stuck with a logical conundrum here. Wardens clearly try to carry out their job with empathy and responsibility, but they participate in a system that can stifle the pain of inmates, and by doing so, make the execution process seem more humane. This is important because lethal injection, the primary method of execution nowadays, is built on the foundation of being the most humane way to kill. If this deception is true, it means that the system and the wardens care more about the image than the inmate. This kind of contradicts the point I was trying to make earlier about empathy. It's an interesting dichotomy and just shows how complex the prison system and interpersonal relationships can be. This concludes part two of the series. We have one more episode looking at how empathy is handled by those who witness executions. On the next episode of Edge of Empathy, we look at the spiritual advisor, one of the closest confidants of the inmate in the final hours. Thank you to BioUnit, Tech Theist, Crowander, and Xylopsycho for the music. These artists are hosted online at the Free Music Archive. I'm Jonathan, and I'll talk to you next time. You're listening to WHUS Stores.